No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and how the tech are ya? It is time for a classic Tech Stuff episode, this originally published on April 8th, 2015. It is the follow-up to last week's classic episode. This one is titled, How Aircraft Carriers Work, Part 2. Enjoy.
The weight of the structural steel alone, 60,000 tons, just in steel on that ship. That's not including all the aircraft and the people and all the other stuff. The total area of the flight deck, I think we said this already, 4.5 acres. The length of the flight deck, 1,092 feet. But again, they don't get to use all of that.
Right.
Some of it's for launching. Some of it's for recovery. It's broken up into different ways. Some of it's for storage. The width of the flight deck, at its widest point, 257 feet wide, which sounds wide, but then again, you got planes, you got people, you got the pilot house. I mean, not the pilot house. What is it?
The island.
The island. Yeah. That's right. Pilot house. Where'd he come up with that? It sounds like a restaurant.
Well, you would technically call it that on a boat, but this is significantly larger than a boat.
I'm going down to the pilot house for some shrimp. You want to come with me? Okay. This is interesting. The weight of each anchor.
Yeah.
Each anchor. 30 tons.
Yeah.
And in each link in the section of anchor chain weighs 360 pounds. Massive.
You need a couple of people just to lift a link. Okay.
Each propeller weighs 66,200 pounds. Each of the rudders weighs 45.5 tons.
Yeah.
That's amazing. All right. How about the storage capacity for aviation fuel, which you would assume would be essential for something like this, because they're not making power from the reactor for the planes.
That's
obviously
true. They still have to carry fuel for the actual planes.
They do. 3.3 million gallons is what they carry.
It's incredible.
Yeah, that sure is. I mean, think about that next time you go to the Georgia Aquarium and they've got that 1 million gallon tank. Okay, number of telephones on board. We're getting into some of the funner stuff. Funner.
Yeah, more fun.
The most fun.
The
most fun stuff. It's the bestest stuff is coming up. The number of telephones on board. 2,500 telephones. The number of televisions on board, 3,000. What are they doing watching TV? They got a ship to run.
That's
You are occasionally allowed a little downtime in the Navy.
Maybe I'm being harsh. I don't know. Anyways, okay.
You'd be quite the quartermaster.
A thousand miles of electrical cable is on board each one of these ships. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let's go down to some of the other stuff. Number of dentists on board, 5.
Yep.
5 dentists. So you gotta have that if you have thousands of people, right?
So they actually do have dental offices aboard.
They carry enough food, to feed 6,000 people for 70 days.
That's a lot of food.
That's a lot of food, a lot of people.
So that's 18,000 meals a day.
Yes, that's right.
Because you multiply it by 3.
18,000 meals. Yeah, you're right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the amount of mail that's processed is on board from the post office. Mm-hmm. 1 million pounds of mail goes to all these people throughout the year.
Incredible.
Let's see. Number of medical doctors on board. This is actually surprisingly low. 6. Yep. 6.
Considering, that it's like 1 per 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty low number.
All right, how about just 2 more to wrap it up here?
Sure.
The number of haircuts that they give every week, 1,500 a week, but there's only 1 barbershop. So to be fair, come on.
A haircut aboard a Navy vessel often involves a pair of electric clippers and not much else.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that list wasn't as fun as I thought it was.
No. But another one to think about is that you've got about 2,500 people who are part of the air wing aboard the vessel. Now, the air wing, that's all the people necessary for the flying and maintaining of aircraft. So it's not just the pilots. It's also the crew that the flight crews, the maintenance crews, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got another 3,000 who are the ship's company. They're the ones who keep the ship running and have their own jobs aboard there,
mm-hmm.
including people who are super secret, like the people who maintain the nuclear reactors, who even aboard ships end up being almost legendary because you don't necessarily know who it is who works on that duty. It's not always something that is common knowledge aboard ship. There's an amazing and truly amazing 10-hour documentary series that PBS did called Carrier, where they follow a bunch of sailors aboard the USS Nimitz, the lead ship of the Nimitz class aircraft carrier.
Sure.
And they talk about their roles aboard the ship, their decisions of going into the Navy, what it's like living aboard this kind of thing. It follows a deployment during the wars in Afghanistan. And so it actually follows these people for a really long time. And it's fascinating. And one of the things they talk about is how, I don't think I've ever met anyone who works in the nuclear reactor area. Or
but
if they do,
they don't.
Yeah, they don't say.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
I like that. I like that that secretive element to the whole thing.
Yeah. So it's really, again, it's a very specific kind of world. And the crew quarters I had referred to, the beds are referred to as racks.
Mm-hmm.
You have a rack of you know. And the racks are tiny. I mean, I don't know if you've seen pictures or video of it, but
I have.
There's barely enough space for you to climb in to get into your little bed.
Mm-hmm.
And they are stacked 3 to a section. So you've got a lower bunk, a middle bunk, and an upper bunk.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are, like I said, there's just enough clearance for you to climb in, essentially.
Yeah.
And in fact, I watched a video of a guy getting in one for the first time and he's like, I'm sure I'm going to get better at this. And this was the top one.
Did he have a bunch of like bruises on his forehead?
Yeah, he had a couple of lumps, you know, here or there. And you have like a tiny locker and maybe a foot locker to keep your belongings in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, and you're just sharing this tiny space and it might be a lot of people sharing a relatively small amount of living space, including a lot of people sharing one bathroom. I mean,
it's no cruise ship. And you know, even if you do go on a cruise ship, oftentimes you'll get into your room and you'll realize like, well, this is a pretty small room, but you've got it pretty plush compared to the military.
It's luxury compared to the military. Yeah.
For sure.
So, really, really an amazing piece of technology. Now I'm going to go through a little bit more about the various aircraft classes that exist, the types of aircraft carriers that have existed in the United States history. And then I think we can conclude by talking a little bit about the Ford class of supercarrier that is soon to be part of the United States Navy and how it has
a couple of interesting, interesting new technological improvements.
Yeah.
That might surprise you because it's not bigger than the Nimitz, really. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it's necessarily faster or that it's able to carry a significantly larger, component of aircraft. It's more about how it's more efficient and it needs fewer people aboard it, which is kind of cool. So going back to the earliest days, the first aircraft carrier that the United States had was referred to as a Langley class aircraft carrier. It was the USS Langley. Mm-hmm. If you hear something class, that means that the name of the class is generally the name of the lead ship of that class. And then other ships in that class were built as using the first one as a reference point. Like that's the model.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the other ships are going to be built based on that. Largely because manufacturing processes at this stage mean that we can actually make copies of stuff.
So there might be a dozen Langley class ships out there.
There could have been.
Or there would have been.
There could have been, yeah.
Yeah, I understand. But then, the first one was named the Langley.
Yes.
Got it.
So in this case, it's a single ship class, meaning that there was only one ever made.
Oh,
for the Langley.
This is a bad example on my part.
But only because we're talking about the very first one.
Yeah.
It was commissioned in 1922 as an aircraft carrier. However, that's not how the Langley got her start. And of course, we refer to ships as ladies.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a previous life as a collier, which is a type of bulk cargo ship. So she was converted from cargo ship to aircraft carrier. She was originally launched as a cargo ship in 1913.
Oh boy.
The conversion process began in 1920, lasted 2 years. She was recommissioned in 1922. And
probably
a
wooden deck, right?
She did not have all the amenities of a modern aircraft carrier.
That's a polite way to say it.
She was slow. She was only capable of traveling at 14 knots, which is less than half of what we're talking about with the supercarriers mm-hmm. these days.
I could run faster than that.
It's a huge problem if you're only going 14 knots
yeah.
because you are not able to generate that amount of airspeed that airplanes would really need to take off.
Yeah.
So it was not, this is one of the reasons why the Langley is the only one in her class, or was the only one, I should say. Now, there was a captain in the Navy who ended up taking control of the Langley. He was given her command and ended up establishing a lot of the handling procedures that became standard operating procedure on aircraft carriers after that. His name was Captain Joseph Reeves. He would eventually rise to the rank of admiral. So a lot of the things that ended up being used every day on aircraft carriers were established because Reeves put those practices into as policy. He said, this is the way we're going to do things. Now the Langley was damaged by Japanese dive bombers in 1942 and the surrounding U.S. ships were forced to scuttle the Langley.
Mm.
So she was sunk by U.S. forces on purpose. Next we have the Lexington class, named after the USS Lexington. That was commissioned in 1927. It was originally a battle cruiser, not an aircraft carrier.
Strange how these, so the first two
yeah.
were not necessarily, they didn't start out life as an aircraft carrier.
Exactly. And there were two ships in the Lexington class. So really the first three aircraft carriers started as something else. Now, here's the interesting thing about why we being the United States, converted a battle cruiser into an aircraft carrier. So you may have heard of things like disarmament treaties.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a new concept. This does not just refer to the nuclear age. It goes back further. Back in the old days, like the 1920s, the big weapons were these giant Navy ships. And so there was a treaty signed, the Washington Naval Treaty of 1922, which placed strict limitations on how many warships a nation would be allowed by international law to have. If the United States built two battle cruisers, battleships, they weren't battle cruisers. Oh, no, they were battle cruisers. So they built two battle cruisers, they would go over their limit. However, aircraft carriers at the time were not considered really warships, they were considered support. So instead of building battle cruisers, they just took the bones of the battle cruisers and converted them into aircraft carriers.
Pretty smart.
Yeah. So this was still in the construction phase. It wasn't like they had them out and sailing and then converted them. It was all from the at the shipyards. The lead ship of the class, the Lexington, was sunk in 1942 during the Battle of the Coral Sea that Scott mentioned. Mm-hmm. The other was the Saratoga, which made it through World War II. She was heavily damaged in a couple of different battles, but she made it through. And she was later sunk on purpose during a test of nuclear weapons.
Yeah. This is interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's when you decide, hey, we're gonna park this here boat right off the Bikini, and then we're gonna blow it up.
Yeah, but you know what? How else are you gonna test that? How else are you gonna figure out how that ship is gonna stand up to an attack like that?
Yeah, as it turns out, it doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It certainly proved it in that case.
Yeah.
Yeah, so very interesting fate for those two. Then you have the Ranger class, another single ship class of ships. So in other words, it's almost funny to call it a class when there's only one.
Yeah.
But that's what we do. So she was commissioned in 1934 and decommissioned in 1946. And this is the first ship that was built to be an aircraft carrier. She was only 730 feet long, or 222.5 meters. I say only because that's much shorter than today's super carriers. Had a full crew complement of 2,461 people. And she was in the Atlantic Ocean during World War II because she was too slow to be deemed useful for the Pacific Theater.
And now you said 730 feet, but that was probably sufficient for prop aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And again, she was built specifically with aircraft carrier in mind. So this was not a conversion. So she was, you know, designed with those elements in mind at that point. Mm-hmm. Although we're still talking about kind of the straight landing takeoff strip that caused so many problems early on.
Sure.
Next, we have the Yorktown class, which was commissioned in 1937. There were three ships built in this class. Of course, the lead ship is the Yorktown. Mm-hmm. She was sunk in 1942 at the Battle of Midway. So when we talk about Midway classes, guess what that's named after? Anyway, the Hornet was another Yorktown class ship. She was sunk also in 1942 at the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. The third ship was the original USS Enterprise.
The original?
Well, original in the sense of aircraft carriers.
Now, you know what? I don't think until this morning when you were talking about it, I don't think I knew that there were two USS Enterprises.
Yeah. Yeah. So this one was a Yorktown class ship. There would later be an Enterprise class ship, also known as the USS Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So if you guys have been watching a lot of Star Trek and you get confused about which Enterprise is which, because there's Enterprise, you know, A, B, C, D, and then, of course, there's the previous ones, that dates back all the way to the Navy days. I mean, and of course, they named the Enterprise after this particular ship. Yeah. This was the most decorated ship in U.S. Navy history.
Hmm. And now it's on the bottom of the ocean.
Well, you can't, you know, man, no one lives forever.
Going through this list, I mean, man, there's a bunch of them down there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, she actually was, she made it through. She was not sunk the way the Yorktown and the Hornet were. So that's something. She was 770 feet long or 230 meters and had a complement of 2,217 crew. Hmm. Next, we get to the Wasp class. Hmm. It's another single ship class. Only one ever made. She was commissioned in 1940, but sunk in 1942 during the Guadalcanal campaign by a Japanese submarine. She was 688 feet long, or 210 meters, and she carried a crew of 2,167 during wartime, or around 1,800 during peacetime. Now, her construction came down to politics. This was one of the things I thought was fascinating. So you remember that treaty I mentioned, the 1922 treaty?
Yeah.
It limited the amount of tonnage the United States was able to dedicate to aircraft carriers, but they had 15,000 tonnage left over after everything else. And they said, well, we don't want that to go to waste. Let's build an aircraft carrier that will make up this tonnage that we have been allotted. And the Wasp was that ship.
That's strange because, okay, you're talking about a 15,000 ton aircraft carrier.
Yeah, compared to like the 30,000 or plus 60,000. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems like it's so small. I mean, how did that even work?
It's called a Wasp.
Maybe it's very thin metal.
Yeah. And she only lasted 2 years before she was sunk.
We'll be back with more about aircraft carriers after this quick break.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town, I use my smartphone to look up things to do, or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue, real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Now we get into one of the... Like, what was the backbone of the United States Navy during World War II? Mm-hmm. That's the Essex class of aircraft carriers, commissioned in 1942. There was also an extended bow variation. The bow is the front end of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
There was an extended bow variation that was commissioned in 1944. There were 24 ships built in the Essex class. There were another 8 that had been planned but were canceled before they could be built. So this was the most plentiful of them. Out of those 24, 14 saw combat during World War II. Not a single one was sunk.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So all of them made it through World War II. They range, because there is an extended bow version, they range from about 820 feet, which is almost 250 meters, to 888 feet, which is about 270 meters.
You know, that kind of makes sense, though, because we were talking about the role reversal and how, you know, that became the primary player then, the aircraft carrier was, during World War II.
Yeah.
So when they went out, you know, these 14 ships that went out and saw action, they were surrounded by support ships.
Yeah.
And they were protecting them fiercely.
Right.
That's probably the difference. That's probably why all 14 made it through that war.
I mean, clearly the biggest danger you face there, I mean, there are plenty of dangers, lots of them, but the biggest one would be submarines,
mm-hmm.
because those would be the hardest to detect. Now, a lot of the aircraft carriers, in fact, all aircraft carriers to my knowledge, have anti-submarine strategies where they deploy what is essentially a decoy that makes a lot of noise, so a submarine ends up focusing on that, torpedoes go toward that, as opposed to going to the actual aircraft carrier. So you don't want to make a lot of noise. Then you have Independence class, commissioned in 1943. This was another conversion. These were light aircraft carriers. They were conversions of Cleveland class light cruisers. So if you look at the list of Independence class ships, you'll see that they have multiple names because they had already had a life as a light cruiser, but now had been converted into aircraft carrier, and they got named a new name in that case.
Oh, confusing.
Yeah, that's weird because sailors generally think that it's bad luck to rename a ship once mm-hmm. it's called it something. But I guess it was technically a different ship by then. Anyway, cruisers are small to medium-sized warships. They usually act as fleet support. In World War II, the United States had need of a lot more aircraft carriers, but they are expensive. They take a lot of time to make. So there weren't a whole lot of options. The best option was to convert stuff that they already had into aircraft carriers rather than have to build new ones.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So 9 ships were converted ultimately in this way. Now, next we have the Midway class, which was commissioned in 1945. There were 3 of these. They were longer than the Essex class. The lead ship of the class, the Midway, remained in service until 1992. 1945 to 1992. Not a bad return on investment.
That is a surprisingly long run.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the aircraft that the United States has depended upon, some of those aircraft have been in service for a really long time. But this is truly, you know, impressive to me.
Yeah, they might have changed a little bit between 1940 and 1990.
They probably got a couple of refits where they changed up a little
probably.
Bit. You know, where, hey, you finally got the compass to stop wobbling. Yeah, so the last action that the Midway saw was in Operation Desert Storm. She took part in that. Mm-hmm. And then she is now a museum in San Diego, California, which is where I got to visit.
As is the case with several of these.
Yeah, a lot of these aircraft carriers are a lot, and I'm not mentioning all of them by name because obviously we're going to be running super long if I did that. But a lot of them are now museums in various locations. Some of them are in the process of being converted into museums for some places.
It's a great use for them.
Yeah, it's really, and it's fascinating to really get an actual look at what the living conditions are like, to see these racks mm-hmm. and see how tiny those bunks are and just think, like anyone who hasn't served time on board a ship, had any service aboard a ship like that, it really kind of gives you a new appreciation for the sacrifice that the men and women who choose to do that, you know, what they go through.
Yeah, no doubt.
Next, we've got the Saipan class, which was commissioned in 1946. There were only 2 ships built in that class. They were shorter. They're 684.6 feet long, 208 meters or so, and they carried a complement of 1,700. They were designed to carry 42 aircraft, including 12 bombers. They had a relatively short service life because, they just weren't as useful once we started getting the development of the jet engine planes, right? Mm-hmm. They were far too short for that. Mm-hmm. So they were converted into command and communication ships in the 1950s. So that meant that we needed to have a new class of ship designed specifically to accommodate jet fighters. Mm-hmm. And here we arrive.
It's like the modern era.
Yeah, this is where we're making that, you know, we're still not quite at the nuclear era, mm-hmm. but we're at the super carrier era. Mm-hmm. This is where we arrive at the aircraft carrier that wasn't. The big one that started but wasn't completed, the United States class.
Yeah,
the USS United States.
Didn't they only work on the beginning production of this thing for just a few days before it was canceled?
They had laid the keel down, depending upon the account you read, it's between 5 and 9 days. Like, the keel was laid out, and within a week or so, it was canceled. And it was supposed to be a ship that would be 1,090 feet long, or 330 meters. So this would have been the longest aircraft carrier up to that point. Mm-hmm. She was supposed to be able to carry 12 to 18 heavy bombers and 54 jet fighters. Now, she was canceled by order of the Secretary of Defense, Lewis A. Johnson, who sided with the Air Force in an argument that was going on between the Air Force and the Navy. The Air Force said, listen, we're in the nuclear age, and the best investment is for us to build lots and lots of long-range bombers that can fly out over a target, drop a nuclear weapon. This is going to be deterrence. We'll never have a war again. And Johnson said, this is the way I want to go. And it led to what was called the Revolt of the Admirals. So you had these admirals in the Navy who all said, no, aircraft carriers are going to still be important. We're going to need a place that we can maneuver into different parts of the world and use as a base of operations for our air strategy.
Sure, our own floating island.
Yeah. So you had the Navy arguing that we still needed to have aircraft carriers and the Air Force arguing that no, we did not. Then a little conflict broke out, the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And the Korean War illustrated that nuclear deterrence would not work in every kind of outbreak of violence. And the United States believed that it had a real stake in the outcome of the Korean War. A fear of the spread of communism was a large part of this. It was all happening as the Cold War is raging.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy said, see, we need aircraft carriers. And so back to building aircraft carriers, the Navy went.
Now, isn't this something, I mean, the research and development, I don't know how long that took before, you know, prior to the start of the build. But to get 9 or 10 days or 5 days or whatever into the build and then just decide to quit.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What a huge waste.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking like $100 million at that point. Then we get the Forrestal class. This is the one that had the famous fire.
Sure.
The USS Forrestal.
Mm-hmm.
That was commissioned in 1955. There were four of them built. And it was the first actual aircraft carriers to be designated as super carriers. All four were decommissioned in the 1990s, and they were 1,070 feet long, about 330 meters, and they still used steam turbines for propulsion, like they steam boilers. They didn't have nuclear reactors yet. The crew complement for that was 4,378. So we're getting bigger.
Well, there's someone down there shoveling coal in.
Yeah, a lot of them, actually.
Burning wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, throw another log on the fire. No. We need to go a little faster.
That's kind of what they're doing.
More steam.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we have the Kitty Hawk class. Now, Kitty Hawk, obviously named after the test flights that the Wright brothers did at Kitty Hawk.
Yeah.
That was commissioned in 1961. There were three ships built in that class. The Kitty Hawk, the Constellation, and the America.
Hmm.
They also used steam turbines. Then we get to the Enterprise class and the next USS Enterprise, commissioned on November 25th, 1961. And, the USS Enterprise is the only ship in this class. They never built any other ones. It was 1,101 feet long, or 1,100 feet, 2 inches long, 335.64 meters. Its flight deck was 252 feet wide, or 75.6 meters. It displaced 89,600 tons with a full load. Its top speed was more than 30 knots, had more than 3,350 members of the ship's company, and another 2,480 as the air wing crew. They had a total of 5,830 people aboard this thing.
Whoa, that's a huge crew.
Huge crew. Its armament included anti-ship missile defense systems and anti-aircraft weapons. And it could hold more than 60 aircraft, and it's to be decommissioned this year.
Oh, man.
This year. So this is one that's probably going to end up being a museum someplace.
I would hope so.
Yeah. And I hope that they hang up pictures from Star Trek everywhere.
All right. We'll be wrapping up the subject of aircraft carriers in just a moment after this quick break.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town, I use my smartphone to look up things to do, or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue, real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Next, we have the Kennedy class. This is a subclass of the Kitty Hawk class of aircraft carriers. It was commissioned in 1968. There's only one of them, or there was only one of them, the John F. Kennedy. And it was decommissioned in 2007. Not quite as long as the Enterprise class, but it had a similar propulsion system, which means, the Enterprise being one that was the first one to have nuclear reactors for propulsion. Mm-hmm. The Kennedy class also had it. So unlike the Kitty Hawk class, this is why it's a subclass, right? It didn't have the steam boilers like Kitty Hawk did. It had nuclear reactors. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's considered a subclass unto itself. It could carry more than 80 aircraft, but it was decommissioned because it was also the most expensive ship to maintain in the fleet, and it was due for a major overhaul, and budget cuts said that that was not going to happen, so they decommissioned it.
Wow.
Yeah. So instead, they built the Nimitz class, and this is what we're using today. Mm-hmm. The largest warship on the seas right now. It's named after World War II Pacific Fleet Commander Chester W. Nimitz. And the Nimitz class was commissioned on May 3rd, 1975. Just a short time before I was born.
Wait, 1975, and we've gone all the way through to 2015 or 2016, really, before we come to the next version of next class of supercarrier.
Right.
Which is the Gerald R. Ford class.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's been in this class of ships has been in service for more than four decades.
Yeah, that's a long time.
The Navy has 10 Nimitz class aircraft carriers. They are 1,092 feet long, 332.85 meters, and 134 at the beam. That's 40.84 meters. That's at the bottom of the ship. So here's the thing. Other thing about aircraft carriers is they kind of have this thing where they're narrow at the bottom and they kind of flare out width-wise at the top.
Yeah.
And obviously you need to have a lot of surface area for your flight deck.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another element of them.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, we've got 10 supercarriers. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is really cool. The ship's company is between 3,000 and 3,200 crew members, plus 1,500 pilots and crew for the air wing, plus 500 staff. So your total is between 5,000 and 5,200 people per super carrier. So that's a lot of folks on
that,
there.
That is. I mean, the logistics of maintaining everything that you have to do. I mean, I know we've talked about it, but even the mail service, the sewage system, fresh food or fresh food and water, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, the barber shop, the dentist, the doctors, all that, coordinating everything has just got to be an incredible undertaking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why you have to have this huge number of staff aboard. I mean, you sit there and think, like, what are they doing? Well, they're making sure everything runs smoothly. They have to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a military operation.
And everybody's there for a specific purpose. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing, is that there's 6,000 people on board, roughly 6,000, that have a specific job that they're doing. It's not like a cruise ship where you go on and, you know, more than half the people are there just to have a good time, you know, and relax. The other half are there to work.
Yeah, you're not going to find a lot of people having a good time aboard an aircraft carrier.
Well, yeah, maybe they
once
are.
Once in a while, get a little like basketball in or something.
Occasionally, yeah. Sure. But the thing is, they've all got a job. I mean, every single one of them. So it's just a different way to look at things.
Yeah. And you might, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the defense systems aboard aircraft carriers, largely because their main weapon are the aircraft, right?
Yeah.
But they do have various defense systems aboard them. With the Nimitz, you're talking about Sea Sparrow missile system, which is an anti-aircraft and anti-missile weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It also has the Phalanx CIWS defense system to protect against anti-ship missiles.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially an automated 20-millimeter Gatling gun that tracks and shoots down incoming missiles.
Awesome.
Yeah. That's... watching videos of this thing working is terrifying.
and also these the surface-to-air missiles that use radar-seeking signals to hone in on whatever they're bouncing the signals off of.
Right.
So that is another cool thing to watch. I mean, to watch watch the missiles reaching their target based on radar.
Yep. And they also have rolling airframe missile mounts, which can launch surface-to-air missiles. Which is another anti-ship cruise missile defense system. So in other words, if an incoming missile is coming toward the aircraft carrier, you can launch one of these to try and destroy the missile before it hits.
And then you already talked about the things that they call the Nixies, right?
Yeah, the Nixies, that's for the anti-submarine.
Yeah, what a cool idea that they deploy decoys behind the ship in order to draw in the torpedo fire.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I think of it kind of like flak for aircraft, where you're trying to make sure by jettisoning lots of stuff that a missile could mistake for the aircraft, so that you can escape without being hit by the weapon.
Clever.
So now we're finally at what is coming up next. So the Nimitz class is the current aircraft carrier the United States Navy depends upon. The next is the Ford class, as we mentioned. It's the same length, more or less, is, you know, essentially the same size as the Nimitz class, but it has a wider flight deck. It's 4 feet wider. It's got 256 feet wide or 78 meters and has two nuclear reactors to provide the propulsion power and electricity. Has the same general top speed as the Nimitz, more or less. Again, the Navy doesn't really want us
to
know.
30, 35 knots, somewhere in there.
But the systems aboard the Ford require fewer personnel. So the total crew of a Ford class ship, remember, Nimitz is 5,000 to 5,200.
Mm-hmm.
Ford class, 4,539.
How did they cut the crew down so much?
It's incredible that they have streamlined systems so that it requires fewer people to maintain and oversee. And it can also hold more aircraft than the Nimitz class vessel, more than 75 of them. Similar armament to Nimitz. And it has some advance in aircraft launches, and one particular that we need to mention. This is how we're going to conclude. We're going to talk about the difference. So we had talked about the steam catapults earlier.
Yeah.
The Ford class is changing. We're finally getting away from these steam powered pistons that launch aircraft. They're switching to an electromagnetic aircraft launch system, also known as EMALS.
I like this idea.
It's a really cool idea.
I got to say that, you know, my initial thought of this was, are they going to be able to shorten the decks? Are they going to be able to make smaller aircraft carriers?
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, well, they still need to store the aircraft. So they're still going to need a massive ship.
Yeah.
It's not going to get dramatically smaller, but they might be able to shorten the length of the takeoff area, or they might be able to provide more runways, more takeoff areas.
Sure.
Because there are some that have as many as, they can launch 3 or 4 airplanes.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? The most I've ever seen launched at one time is 3, simultaneously.
But yeah, you could have like 4 or 5 catapult areas.
Yes.
And the EMALS ones can reset much faster than the STEAM ones. Within 45 seconds, they can reset to be able to launch another aircraft. Now, it's probably going to take longer than 45 seconds for you to get the next aircraft hooked up and ready to go,
yeah,
but that's how long the system requires before it can launch again. So it's very fast. There are some downsides. I'll get to it in a second. But the general way this works is that it works on the basic principles of magnetism, right? Where like poles on a magnet repel and opposite poles attract. So remember that shuttle we talked about with the steam-powered one? Same sort of thing. You've got a shuttle there. And you have a leading edge, the front side of the shuttle, the part that the tow bar is going to connect to. And then you have the back edge of the shuttle. And you've got these two rails that are on either side of the shuttle, just like the pistons would be on the steam-powered one. Mm-hmm. But instead of using steam, you're using electricity to generate magnetic fields. And you are pulling the shuttle in the front. You're creating an opposite charge so it attracts the front of the shuttle as it starts to, you know, it wants to move toward that opposite.
Yeah, it's going to slam into the other end.
And then you use the same charge on the back to push the shuttle. So you're pulling and pushing it at the same time. And by fluctuating this magnetic field at a particular speed down the length of these rails, you propel the shuttle very, very quickly down the rails. Now, the power of that push is dependent on a couple of different things. The length of the rails, which in this case are about 300 feet in length, and the amount of current you're putting through it. So that means you've got to put a lot of current. We're talking about a lot of electricity, a huge amount. We're talking 100 million watts per launch, which...
You sound like Dr. Evil.
Yeah, 100 million watts. Doing the pinky thing, just in case you guys can't see. Also, that's the same amount of electricity a small town would use in that same amount of time.
Mm.
So every time you launch, you're using, within that 45 seconds of launch and recovery, you're using essentially the same amount of electricity a town would use in that 45 seconds.
All right, but let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Because you've got a nuclear reactor.
you're creating it yourself. You're using what you create. It's not like you're taking it from somebody else to use it.
Yeah, they don't have a extension cord leading all the way back to DC or something.
And I don't mean to trivialize it or anything.
No, but I mean,
it's interesting. And I wonder how many, I wonder what safety aspects this brings up or safety concerns this brings up for crew members working on the deck.
Well,
because there's a lot of crew members that each have their own job and they've got their head down doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
There's going to be brand new procedures for this, no doubt.
Sure, yeah. It requires a smaller crew than the steam-powered version does, but obviously that crew does need to be alert because if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, I mean, when those jet engines fire up, I read a story about a guy aboard an aircraft carrier who got sucked into the intake, but did not get sucked into the actual jet engine itself. He suffered injuries, but they were not critical injuries because he didn't get pulled all the way into the engine. He was just stuck in a terribly uncomfortable position right at the very entrance of it. But that's a real concern, you know, and that's going to be a concern whether it's a steam powered one or electromagnetic. Cause again, the pilot's still going to have to power up full throttle so that they can take off properly.
Okay. I was getting more to the point of, somebody whose job it is to hook up the shuttle to the landing gear.
Yeah.
And if they mistakenly touch, don't touch the metal on the plane and the metal on the deck here at the same time.
Yeah.
I understand, but there's also huge dangers with the steam powered device as well.
You're talking about a massive amount of steam under huge pressure.
Hey,
right?
Something's going to throw a plane off of a ship. I mean, it's going to be dangerous
right.
no matter what.
Right. So this has been one of those things that some people have claimed has held up the development of the Ford supercarrier because obviously, like we're saying, you need to make sure the system is going to work. It's going to replace something that already exists. So there's some who would argue, well, why are you replacing something that has been proven to work?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is that, well, this system could potentially take up much less space You still have to have a massive amount of space just for the power generator to send the electricity to the rails, but it's still going to be smaller than the steam pistons that you'd be using, at least directly under the deck. You know, it uses, again, a smaller crew, so you don't need to have as many people aboard your aircraft carrier.
Yep, military is going to like that.
Yeah. So, you know, not the most electrically efficient device, maybe, but still really fascinating.
Yeah, maybe I should clarify that. The military budget people are going to like that. But the thing is, I wonder if it's going to be any faster than the steam system or if it's going to be more capable than the steam system as far as, you know, the launch distance, the launch time. Because we said that it launches a plane in 2 seconds and it's going 165 miles per hour when it at the end of that travel.
Well, I mean, it is the difference between changing the electric current along a rail versus the mechanical action of a piston being pushed forward.
So I guess you're going 165 miles per hour instantly.
Yeah.
Instead of approaching that and then at launch.
Yeah, your acceleration could be even faster, I would imagine.
Wow.
I mean, I also imagine that they set it so it's not that, because you obviously don't want to cause injury to the pilot or damage the vehicle. But,
Could be lethal.
Yeah. At that sort of speed. So, this was really a lot of fun to talk about. And, you know, when we first started, I wasn't sure if we were going to get two episodes out of it, but we sure did.
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
I can tell already. So here's another peek behind the curtain for you new listeners out there. Sometimes we don't know how long an episode's going to be, and we don't know how, you know, whether or not something's going to be one part or two parts. And the funny thing is, you've already listened to part one, and this is the end of part two. But we didn't know it was going to be the end of part two until I looked down at Scott's timing device and saw that we're well over an hour and a half if we wanted to release this as one episode.
You were giving them all the secrets.
I know, right? Well, I mean, come on. We just had Tech Stuff 700th episode, so I feel like we've had a few moments, me and the listeners.
Probably.
So, Scott, thank you so much for joining me for these two episodes. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know what? Once again, I had a lot of fun talking about this. You know way more about aircraft carriers than I do, obviously, but I had a great time, and it's always a good conversation. So thank you for inviting me, and I'd gladly do it again.
Fantastic. And next time, I swear, I'll pick something car-related.
Hope you enjoyed that classic episode about how aircraft carriers work. We'll be back with an all-new old episode next week. I think. I'm trying to parse that. I don't know. I need more coffee. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover on future episodes of Tech Stuff, please reach out to me on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.